Chapter 9. Niagara System. 2300 August 7th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. BB-285, St. Michael.
I hope, sir, that you weren't expecting to find anything useful here,
Vice Admiral Lindsay Tasker said bluntly over the QCOM link.
They blew the repair yards, the storage depots, everything. Void, sir, they did a better job wrecking the base than we did when we left Via Somnia.
That, Admiral Tasker, is because the Alliance realized there was a possibility of losing the fleet base.
Fleet Admiral James Calvin Walkingstick, Marshal of the Rimward Marches for the Terran Commonwealth, observed acidly.
Something that our own compatriots apparently failed at.
The big, bronze-skinned marshal adjusted his long braid in a practiced gesture that appeared random, but was actually a calming meditation.
We don't expect to lose, Tasker agreed. An idea that both the Alliance and the League have happily disabused us of late. Speaking of Via Somnia...
James shrugged with a cold smile.
You could retake it, I suppose, but my intelligence suggests that Midori's defenders retreated there, he pointed out. We may have ground their 7th Fleet down to something that doesn't deserve the title anymore, but with Rothenberg's ships and the defenses they moved in, it would be an even fight. I hate even fights. Besides, why bother? He shrugged. It's not like Via Somnia has anything there other than the fleet base. We advance onwards and cut off its supply chain. They will have to abandon the base eventually as we take systems behind them. It is useless without something to defend, after all.
Speaking of things other than the fleet base, we're going to need more troops, Tasker told him. Lieutenant General Peck apparently underestimated the locals' willingness to fight. It didn't end well.
How bad?
The marshal asked levelly. Vlago Peck had 8 transports worth of power-armored marines, each carrying an entire division. The man had an entire marine expeditionary group under his command. He shouldn't need reinforcements.
He opened his landings with 2 divisions, Tasker replied. They no longer exist, to all intents and purposes. Something like 7,000 dead, half again that wounded.
James concealed a wince. 16,000-plus casualties was 80% losses of 2 divisions. Tasker was right. Those units were functionally gone.
I'm sure Peck has reported this up his chain of command, but it may not have made its way back down to you,
his admiral continued.
Most of the MEG is tied up securing Midori. I don't think we're going to be breaking any of Peck's troops free for further operations anytime soon. And frankly, I want a new Marine CO.
Peck, James suspected, was spinning his reports to his own superiors to blame a lack of Navy fire support for his failings. That his fire support was supposed to come from his own transports could easily be obfuscated when Tasker had 18 capital ships in orbit.
If I need to dig up another expeditionary group, that will delay things, he warned. Are you capable of proceeding?
My Lexingtons are shuttling new starfighter crews back and forth as we speak, Tasker told him. Even with the logistics helping out, it'll be another week before I have my wings back up to strength.
She shook her head.
I need more carriers, sir, she admitted. 8 battleships looked impressive as hell on paper, but we didn't have enough starfighters to blunt their bomber strike. With Vesuvius gone, I really don't have enough katanas to go up against anything resembling a comparable Alliance fleet.
The rest of the volcanoes are with Gabor, James pointed out, and the Alliance hasn't seen him coming yet. I'll see what I can pull free from our other positions, but it'll be Lexingtons and Assassins.
The only 60 million cubic ship he had sitting in his reserve was St. Michael, and while he could send her forward, his superiors would explode if he went with her.
None of the new ships, huh?
Most of them went after the League, James reminded Tasker. We have what we need, Admiral. I'll have replacement starships and a new MEG out to you within 2 weeks. After that, well, I'm going to have work for you.
Only reward for a job well done, Tasker agreed brightly. Lay it on me, boss.
Chapter 10 Via Somnia System 0800, August 19th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. DSC 062, Normandy.
So, did anybody else not know we were expecting a battle fleet?
Russell asked quietly over the tactical feed as the Alcubierre Stetson emergencies died down.
It seems Admiral Rothenberg had enough of a heads up to make sure that nobody accidentally went over the top when they showed up,
Herrera pointed out.
But still, that's an Imperial fleet. Even with the Alliance, I always kind of half-figured I'd end up on the wrong side of one of those sooner or later.
The CAG just nodded. He was sitting in his office right now, but was linked into a virtual conference of Normandy's senior officers that Herrera had called as soon as the sensors started reporting emergence signatures.
We've broken it down,
Commander Tyreek Vang, Normandy's tactical officer, reported.
Confirmed with the rest of the fleet, too. We're looking at 16 ships, but only 10 are warships, he continued. 3 Righteous-class carriers, 3 Defender-class battlecruisers, 2 Majesty-class strike cruisers, and 2 Ramses-class strike cruisers. 8 modern ships, 40 to 50 million cubics, and 2 older units.
With Righteous Fire, that's half of the Imperium's Righteous-class carriers, Herrera noted. They've got 2 Imperator-class ships that just commissioned, sanctuaries with the serial numbers filed off, but that's still 40% of Coraline's modern carrier force. What the hell is going on? Russell demanded.
I don't know,
the captain replied.
What I do know is that I just got pinged by the Vice Admiral. Captains, CAGs, and XOs to report aboard Righteous Fire for what sounds like a fancy meet-and-greet. Dress uniforms, gentlemen, he concluded with a grin Russell could feel through the link. This is more capital ships than the Alliance has concentrated since Fourth Fleet hammered the Commonwealth back to the frontier. Something is going down, people. And when it does, Normandy will not be found wanting. You get me?
Righteous Fire turned out to have a massive open space that was easily repurposed as a ballroom. Or, quite possibly, was a ballroom that was easily repurposed for other uses. Russell would have called the latter an extravagant waste of space, but Federation warships all carried an atrium, roughly an acre in size, as part of the life support system. Warships didn't have a lot of excess space, but despite his own dislike of established nobilities, he couldn't complain about the ballroom. He liked having an atrium on his own ships, after all. Right now, however, Vice Admiral Rothenberg had gathered the senior officers of 24 Alliance capital ships into that room, along with 5 flag officers, 2 Imperial and 3 from different Allied powers, and their staffs. Rothenberg had taken the time to greet each of the 100-plus officers as they'd entered and directed them all toward the buffet, where Russell had discovered that, if nothing else, aristocracy could feed people. His wife's pastries were better, but these had been baked this morning. He was sure the rest of the buffet was perfectly fine, but he happily settled in next to the dessert table, watching the swirl of officers. The party was the first time since the war began that he'd been in a room that wasn't dominated by Federation officers. The Imperium was the Alliance's second-largest military power, but the Federation's stronger economy meant that while they'd have identical active fleets, the Federation had twice as many reserved ships, and had been able to build new ships faster as well. The Federation hadn't spearheaded every major fleet action of the war, but they had led every formation Russell had served in. With 15 Coraline capital ships and 2 flag officers in Via Somnia, however, the Imperials weren't only the largest contingent at the party. They were the majority. Since it was also their ship, the party was definitely tuned to their taste, which was ever so slightly off to Russell. A Federation party would have had subtle incense, several punch bowls, an entirely self-serve buffet. With an Imperial party, there were several stewards along the line of the buffet, preparing specific dishes or carving meat, and there was no drinks section at all. There was no incense wafting through the room, but there were uniformed stewards drifting through the crowd, collecting drink orders and using their implants to unerringly deliver them on request. Or perhaps even before request, the Vice Commodore realized as one of the stewards materialized at his right arm with a long-stemmed flute.
"Orange juice and sparkling water, Vice Commodore Rokos?"
The middle-aged man in a chief petty officer's dress uniform with steward tabs asked politely. Russell chuckled and shook his head.
"I see the Admiral has files on us all," he noted.
The only time he ever drank alcohol on ship was when beer was being handed out as celebration, and that was more for the principle of the thing than anything else.
"More accurately, his head steward,"
the steward replied as Russell took the drink.
"That would, after all, be our job, Vice Commodore."
He smiled.
"The beef pasties on table 3 might also be to your taste," he noted. "The Coraline pasty is a solid evolution of the Cornish original, if I say so myself."
Russell laughed again.
"All right, Chief, I'll try those," he promised. "Thank you."
The man inclined his head and drifted away. 3 more drinks, likely each as uniquely tailored to the intended recipient as Russell's.
"Imperials,"
Captain Herrera muttered in his other ear.
"They know how to make you feel pampered, but I'll be damned if it isn't vaguely creepy at times." "They can fight," Russell pointed out.
"They can," his captain agreed. "But some days I swear we have more in common with the Commonwealth than with many of our allies."
"Except for the whole trying to conquer us business,"
the CAG agreed. Herrera laughed.
"Fair enough," he conceded.
"Looks like our newest Imperial friend is about to speak. Find yourself a seat or a wall, Vice-Com. Looks like it might be time to work."
The tiny admiral with Rothenberg tapped a spoon on her wine glass as she stood on the dais at the end of the ballroom. The room's acoustics were impressive. The gentle noise carried through the entire space, over conversations and the sound of eating. A lot of people had noticed her getting up and turned their attention to her, but the room's design allowed her gesture to gather everyone's attention.
"Officers of the Alliance," she greeted them all. "A toast."
She raised her glass.
"Spacers of the Free Stars, I give you liberty and the Alliance."
"Liberty and the Alliance,"
the crowd echoed back. The loyalty toast forged in the fires of the first war against the Commonwealth before many of these officers were born.
"For those of you who don't know me," she continued after a moment, "I am Rear Admiral the Elector Yong Ju Von Song. I was the passage commander for Convoy X-73, the warships and transports that arrived this morning. I am charged today to speak for my master, Imperator John Erasmus Michael Albrecht von Korl,"
she reeled off crisply.
"I bear his writ and, in this, speak with his voice."
She smiled.
"Vice Admiral Rothenberg, stand up, please,"
she instructed her superior. Rothenberg rose. The Vice Admiral was darker skinned than the Asiatic Von Song, taller and less graceful than the petite woman currently speaking for his ruler.
"For any who will wonder,"
Von Song continued,
"I was dispatched with my master's writ before the Battle of Midori, but I have confirmed his will with him. Parth Rothenberg, it is my honor and privilege to inform you that you are promoted to the rank of Fleet Admiral,"
she told the tall man, passing him a new set of insignia.
"His Majesty sends his congratulations and his certainty of your continued loyal and skilled service."
Rothenberg took the insignia and carefully replaced the 2 gold stars on each side of his collar with the sets of 3 Von Song had given him.
"He does me too much credit," he said slowly. "My life is the Imperium's."
"And he calls upon you to serve the Imperium,"
Von Song replied,
"as he called upon us all. Good luck, old friend."
They traded smiles, but then Von Song returned to her seat, and Vice Admiral Connors rose.
"I have my own communications from Alliance Commander,"
she told Rothenberg and everyone else in the room.
"As of this evening, Fleet Admiral Rothenberg is now the commanding officer of 7th Fleet, absorbing both Task Force Midori and Convoy X-73's escort into that formation."
She saluted him crisply. Rothenberg shook his head but returned the salute.
"I relieve you, Vice Admiral Connors,"
he told the red-headed trade factor officer.
"Thank you."
"I stand relieved. or sit, as the case may be.
Connors concluded with a grin as she retook her seat. Still shaking his head, Rothenberg faced the crowd.
It's not every day you get ambushed like this, he said dryly. I should have guessed when I was asked to host this little affair. It will take us a few days to sort out the exact chain of command and division of ships and authority, he continued with a smile. I doubt the Alliance has assembled this large a fleet for decorative purposes, but for the moment our primary purpose is to protect Via Somnia. Many of these ships are supposed to be somewhere else, which means we hope the Commonwealth will underestimate our defenses here. If they do, they're going to get an ugly shock. An even uglier one if they wait a few days.
Russell leaned forward to hear what the Admiral was suggesting, and he doubted he was the only one.
The Imperium isn't the only one to have sent reinforcements. An entire Alliance battle fleet is on its way as well, under Vice Admiral Roberts. My understanding is that the Fox himself won't be joining Seventh Fleet, which means the Alliance has other work for him.
Rothenberg grinned evilly.
I won't pretend I wouldn't rather take the offensive myself, but between myself and the Stellar Fox, I don't think Walking Stick's going to enjoy the next stage of his plans.
Chapter 11 Via Somnia System 1200, August 21st, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. DSC 080, Elysium.
Emergence in 5 minutes,
Captain Novak informed Kyle over the implant network.
Elysium is clean across the board.
Thank you, Captain, he told her.
He turned on his flag deck to level a questioning look at Senior Fleet Commander Sterling.
Archie?
All ships report green,
his chief of staff replied instantly.
If something has changed since our last update, we've got 13 capital ships ready to kick whoever's causing trouble all the way back to Earth.
Kyle smiled. That hopefully won't be required. Last I checked, our update from Via Somnia Control is what, 2 minutes old?
Less,
Sterling said cheerfully.
We are linked in live. Seventh Fleet is looking big and intimidating.
26 capital ships, 15 of them Imperial?
Kyle shook his head.
They'd better.
Once his own convoy, including 41st Fleet, arrived, Via Somnia would have almost 40 capital ships in one place. The largest force Kyle had ever seen before had been 12, and the most he'd commanded before this convoy had been 4.
Any concerns on control scans?
Nothing,
Sterling replied.
Not a peep. If we were hoping for the Commonwealth to stick their nose in this wasp's nest, I think they've chosen to decline.
Shame, Kyle said mildly. We'll have to make them reconsider that. Do you have a meeting set up with Rothenberg?
1900 this evening.
His chief of staff replied instantly.
His chief of staff said they'd got some of the microbrews the Imperator introduced you to when you visited Coral.
The Vice Admiral chuckled.
Somehow I'm not surprised Von Coral passed that tidbit on, he observed. What do you think, Archie? Imperial starburst or no?
The last battle Kyle had taken Avalon into, while part of Seventh Fleet, in fact, had included his rescuing several hundred thousand prisoners of war. Many of them Imperial. In exchange, when he'd passed through Coral on his way rimward, the Imperator had hung their highest award for valor on him.
Well, unless I miss my read, this is going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight for which ships go to 41st Fleet instead of 7th,
Sterling noted.
Reminding the Elector that the Imperium owes you isn't a bad place to start.
Kyle smiled.
Mostly, I just want his Federation supercarrier and battleship. He observed. But you're not wrong. I might as well get some use out of the starburst. I keep having to feed the thing, after all.
The native coral of the Coraline Imperium's capital planet had a great deal of symbolic meaning to the Imperials, which meant that, among other things, the platinum and coral Imperial starburst was actually still alive. Fortunately for it, the Imperator had given Kyle easy-to-follow instructions for taking care of it. They apparently didn't expect officers to be able to baby their living jewelry, after all.
I'll have Lionel lay out my dress uniform with decorations, then,
he admitted with a sigh.
If we're lucky, this will be the hardest fight of this campaign.
Somehow, Kyle doubted that was going to be the case.
Righteous Fire was only slightly more than half Elysium's size, but there were no shortcomings in her crew.
Kyle was met by a perfectly turned-out honor guard of Imperial Marines, with Admiral Rothenberg waiting beyond them with his chief of staff and Righteous Fire's commander.
Lord Captain Dietlinde Kistner was a stoutly built woman with shockingly pale skin and hair, edging almost into full albinism. From her quick, careful looks around the flight deck as Kyle passed between the honor guard, anyone who embarrassed her in front of the Federation Admiral was going to get an earful.
From the looks of the crew, confidently going about their business away from the landed shuttle, that wasn't going to be much of a worry. Kyle offered Rothenberg his hand as the Imperial closed the distance with a brisk step.
"Welcome aboard Righteous Fire, Admiral Roberts."
"Thank you for having me, Admiral Rothenberg," Kyle told him. "I've never been aboard one of your Righteous-class ships." Rothenberg smiled.
"I'm sure Captain Kistner would be happy to give you a tour," he replied.
"I know they're no match for your sanctuaries, but not much in the galaxy is."
"You'll have the Armada designs soon enough," Kyle murmured. "The Istamans make even the sanctuaries look slow and lightly armed."
Project Armada had taken the best technology from all of the Alliance powers, resulting in a carrier that was slightly smaller than a sanctuary, that carried almost 100 more starfighters, a third again as many missile launchers, and fewer but heavier positron lances. The Istamin-class supercarrier wasn't quite as well defended as a sanctuary, but with over 300 starfighters and bombers aboard, if someone was actually close enough to shoot at her, they'd done something wrong.
3 years,
Rothenberg replied, equally softly.
"We'll have the new fighters and bombers first, though I don't know if they'll be that large an advantage."
"We'll see. I've only seen the specs for our 8th-gen starfighter, not the 2nd-generation bombers," Kyle admitted. "The Reaper is a terrifying piece of hardware." "But," he shrugged, "months before we've produced enough of them to be worth deploying."
"You go to war with the ships you have, not the ships you'd want," Rothenberg agreed.
"Which, as I understand, is what you and I need to discuss." Kyle smiled brightly and buffed the Imperial Starburst.
"Indeed, Admiral. Shall we?"
Rothenberg's office showed the signs of a room the occupant had lived in for some time. A picture of an older woman accompanied by 3 children of ages varying from junior officer to barely not toddler hung on one wall, the familial resemblance to the Admiral clear in the children. The only other picture was a painting of the planet Coral from space. The artist had managed to capture the rings of industrial plants and fortifications in a glittering spray of light that turned mechanical necessity into a stark beauty. The reason for the lack of pictures, however, was that the Imperial Admiral had installed bookshelves in every space he could squeeze them into. They were quality shelves, too, built from a dark, real wood Kyle presumed to be native to Coral. Those shelves were double-stacked with paper books, about 40% fiction and the rest physics, sociology, and military history texts. Kyle was familiar with many of the reference texts, though he'd read them via implant download back when his implant capacity had been greater.
"My hobby," Rothenberg explained, gesturing at the shelves as he took his desk. "I don't have as much implant bandwidth as most, so I find paper easier to intake than a straight data stream."
If the Admiral's implant bandwidth was below average, it was impressive that he'd had a military career at all, let alone risen as high as he had with the reputation he'd earned along the way.
"When I lost my bandwidth, I was carrying a data tablet for months," Kyle replied. "It was easier to read things on a screen than to deal with the limits of my implant. That was mostly an adjustment, though."
A near miss from an antimatter missile had destroyed Kyle's original implant. The damage had scarred portions of his brain, meaning he could no longer link into an implant to nearly the same capacity he'd had before. Neural scarification-induced implant degradation, NSID, a plain acronym for a disorder that had taken Kyle out of a starfighter cockpit and put him on the bridge of a starship.
"I've read your file," Rothenberg said. "From everything I saw, you were lucky to live at all."
"I owe that to Williams, who is now CAG aboard my flagship,
So I think we all did well out of that, Kyle noted with a chuckle.
The Alliance did well out of you living, the Imperial said. No one is going to say you single-handedly turned the tide of the war or anything, but you've done well by us.
I try, the younger man said cheerfully. And now it seems you and I get to arm wrestle over how many ships I get to try my next stunt with.
Rothenberg laughed. Am I cleared to even know what your next stunt is?
Yes, actually, Kyle told him. You're just not cleared to know what you're doing with the ships I leave you.
The senior admiral shook his head, still laughing. That is strange, you have to admit.
My mission kicks off now, Kyle said. Yours, well, I can't say more without telling you things that might cost me my commission.
Fair, Rothenberg allowed.
So what is your mission, then?
To cause bloody havoc along the frontier, Kyle explained. I need to interrupt Walking Stick's offensive by making the systems along the border scream for help. Most of our offensives so far have been specific and directed, targeting Commonwealth fleet bases or retaking systems we lost.
This will be neither of those things, he said grimly. I'm going to bounce from system to system along the frontier, smashing local defense forces and forcing them to evacuate and shred orbital industry.
There'd be a fine line to walk there. Destroying industry was one thing. Doing so without evacuating people was an atrocity. One even the Commonwealth generally avoided, except when their fanatics got stupid. He had no intention of causing a single civilian casualty he didn't have to. That might mean he'd have to leave some systems industry mostly intact to evade Commonwealth retaliation. But given that his purpose was to pull those ships away from attacking the Alliance, that was fine by him.
That's overdue, Rothenberg noted.
Damn. They're not going to see it coming, are they?
Even in the last war, we fought mostly defensively, Kyle agreed. No inhabited Commonwealth system has been taken, even temporarily, by an enemy. Ever.
His smile was cheerful. I figure we can wreck, oh, somewhere between 4 and 6 before Walking Stick catches up. Some of those systems were critical to Walking Stick's logistics, but only some of them would be. He had enough intelligence to target just the important systems, but he didn't want to be obvious about having it.
So you want what? Everything? The Imperial asked.
Kyle grinned. Nah, that would be overkill, and you're going to need them.
What can you give me? He asked.
I've already been told I won't keep Avalon or Kronos, Rothenberg replied. That gives you at least 3 ships, 2 supercarriers and a super battleship. Out of what you brought, what was already marked for 41st Fleet?
Elysium, Gaia, and Carolus Rex, Kyle reeled off. That gives me 5. I want Genghis Khan, Admiral.
That leaves me with just Napoleon for modern ships, the Imperial objected.
And if I thought you'd give her to me, I'd ask for Napoleon, Kyle pointed out. Instead, I'm open for suggestions. I need a minimum of 10 ships, Admiral, and as big and as ugly as I can get.
Rothenberg shook his head, but he was grinning.
I'm not giving you every modern battlecruiser I've got, he said firmly. But I do have Magellan, and that kind of raiding operation is probably a better use for battleships than whatever I'm doing.
Magellan was a Renaissance trade factor battleship, roughly 3/4 of the size of the 2 Titan-class ships.
3 battleships, 2 battlecruisers, 2 carriers, Kyle noted. Not much of a fleet to play Matador to Marshal Walking Stick.
I can't let you go out on this kind of operation without any Imperial contribution, Rothenberg told him.
Righteous Light, Righteous Sword, and Righteous Voice would bring you up to your 10, wouldn't they?
Kyle's grin widened. 3 fleet carriers backing up his 2 supercarriers would make this whole endeavor extraordinarily painful for the Commonwealth.
That would bring me up to 10 indeed, he confirmed. They're each carrying, what, 4 of your squadrons of Vultures?
40 bombers apiece, Rothenberg confirmed,
plus 120 Arrow B-types.
If that would be acceptable?
I don't know what the Commonwealth is going to think, but I'll take it, Kyle agreed. I was expecting more of a fight, to be honest.
The
the Imperial Admiral laughed. "Seventh Fleet still has 29 starships, Admiral Roberts," he pointed out. "Even slicing off 10 for your 41st Fleet, I still have one of the largest fleet commands the Alliance has ever assembled." Kyle nodded. What Rothenberg didn't know was that 7th Fleet was supposed to receive another tranche of reinforcements, at least 4 ships each from the Star Kingdom of Phoenix and the Renaissance Trade Factor. Once they arrived, Rothenberg would command the single largest concentration of force the Alliance had ever put together. Which meant that despite Kyle's not having been briefed on the target allocation, he knew exactly where 7th Fleet was going. "I'll need time to work them up as a unit," he noted. "There won't be any penny packet deploying this time. We put together a sledgehammer, and I don't want to miss with it." "No one wants you to," the Imperial replied. "I don't know what your orders are, Admiral Roberts. Not in detail. Any assistance 7th Fleet or Via Somnia can provide, however, we will be glad to give. Let me be the first to wish you good luck." "I'll take it, but I hope to not need it," Kyle told him. "If I have my way, shock and aggression are all I'll need." Chapter 12. Via Somnia System. 1200, August 22nd, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. DSC 062 Normandy.
"Somebody's trying too hard," Russell murmured, watching the enemy starfighters flare out in front of him.
"Sir?" His gunner, Jan Hu, asked. "I don't get it."
"They know they're working for the Fox, so they're trying to be clever," he concluded. "And they're expecting us to try and be clever."
He thought a sequence of commands at the tactical feed, highlighting what he'd picked up.
"Their vectors are designed to swing them around us, stopping us from flanking them and opening up a whole bunch of sensor angles to stop us pulling, say, the Spartacus protocol on them."
"I see," Hu said slowly.
"But they've spread themselves thin, and only about 10% of them will have lance range on us if we go straight down the middle," the CAG said fiercely. "Which means, all units, form on SFG-292 actual," he snapped over the main net. "I've spotted a hole and I'm taking everybody right into it."
"Follow Rokos," Aza Lynch immediately confirmed.
"I think I see it too. This is risky if they're playing us, Rokos."
Russell checked the vectors.
"I could see Roberts doing that," he admitted to his boss. "But these guys, they're trying to be clever like they think he'd want, but they didn't think it all the way through. They've committed hard to the counterflank."
"And far too obviously," Aza Lynch agreed.
"You've got the shot, Rokos. Let's take it."
The AI running the simulations was smart. Very smart. It could tell when the humans had made decisions and committed to a course of action and accelerated the apparent time in the simulation. Minutes flicked by in seconds as the hundreds of thousands of virtual kilometers blinked away.
"Fighters, form up to shield the vultures,"
Aza Lynch ordered, the simulation slowing as he began to adjust his formation. They'd brought exactly the same numbers of fighters as 41st Fleet to the exercise as a test. Russell also knew that Roberts himself was just an observer, not giving orders or getting involved. Knowing the Admiral, he suspected that Roberts had seen exactly how his people had screwed up and was busy biting his tongue.
"Missile salvoing," Hu announced. "Looks like someone could go for a damn walk out there."
2,000-odd starfighters put a lot of missiles into space, but that was still an exaggeration. The missiles weren't Russell's concern, though. He'd leave the defensive ECM and lasers to his engineer. No, his eyes were on the vectors and ranges for his starfighters' lances. None of the Chevaliers with their heavier weapons were in play today. This was just Falcons and Arrows, both carrying identical deflectors and positron lances.
"And here we go."
At starfighter engagement velocities, lance range lasted seconds at most. The simulator could draw it out, much as it had accelerated time before, but it wouldn't. The point was to practice as close to reality as possible without wasting time in flight. Of the almost 900 starfighters in 41st Fleet's formation, barely 150 were in range as 7th Fleet's fighters flashed through. None of those ships survived, and they only took 40 of Aza Lynch's starfighters with them, and none of the bombers.
Coming up on 41st Fleet, Ossalynch said calmly. We're clear of the fighters. Let's do this nice and easy. Bombers, salvo torpedoes at 1.5 million kilometers. Everyone, salvo starfighter missiles at 700,000 clicks. We'll hit anything left with lances.
Kyle watched silently as 7th Fleet's fighters swarmed over the icons representing his own fleet. Genghis Khan died first, then Avalon, then Elysium. Carolus Rex survived the torpedo strike, only to fall to the missiles along with all 3 Righteous-class carriers. The 3 battleships somehow survived every single torpedo and missile, but over half of 7th Fleet's starfighters remained when they swarmed over the ships. And 500 positron lances were too much, even for the Federation's mighty super battleships.
Well,
he let the single word hang in the silence of his flag deck.
Well, he repeated, studying the sequence of events in his implant. It appears that I owe Vice Commodore Rokos some beer. A lot of beer.
He paused thoughtfully and glanced over at Sterling.
Archie, how much beer does it take to make 3,000 fighter jocks stop bragging?
He asked with a degree of false plaintiveness in his voice.
I'm not sure your salary stretches to that, sir,
his chief of staff told him.
Damn. Well, then we're just going to have to do better next time, aren't we?
Kyle asked aloud, glancing around his staff. They were all very distinctly busy.
CAG debrief in 1 hour, he told them. And Archie?
Sir?
Get in touch with 7th Fleet's canteens. Beer for the fighter jocks is on 41st Fleet's tab tonight.
He grinned.
Gods know they've earned it, but you're right. I can't pay for it. I also don't have to. I have a budget for this.
41st Fleet's CAGs were present aboard Elysium in person. The CAGs from 7th Fleet's carriers were present by virtual link. Everyone from the exercise was linked in, as were Admiral Rutherford and both flag officers' staffs.
Well, Kyle said brightly, it appears that Commodore Ossalynch and his people have demonstrated something of what happens when we epically fuck up.
His tone was still bright and cheerful, but the emphasis on the last 3 words had every one of his CAGs recoiling. Well, every one of them except Michelle Williams Alvarez, who looked about ready to deliver the same lecture he was going to lay on them. She was his most junior vice commodore, however, which meant she wasn't Fleet CAG despite being the flagship's CAG, and he guessed that his other CAGs weren't giving her comments the weight they might deserve.
Does anyone want to try and defend themselves before I explain exactly how you managed to accidentally wipe out an entire 10-ship battle fleet?
He continued.
Anyone?
The fact that his CAGs were all in the room with him meant he was quite certain there wasn't anything on the floor, despite their simultaneous study of it.
We got fancy and clever, he said after a moment. Too fancy, too clever.
It usually works for you,
someone muttered. Kyle carefully didn't note which officer had spoken.
The trick, people, is to get exactly fancy enough, he told them. Ossalynch's people hadn't settled on an attack plan yet. They hadn't done anything to suggest their course or their plan, but instead of holding position, we got fancy. And we committed to that fancy. Isaac Newton is the deadliest son of a bitch in space. And sometimes that's because he says you can't change course on a dime, Kyle continued. You may have 500 Gs of acceleration, but every second you're pointed in the wrong direction is an extra second you have to spend accelerating to get back to the right one. So when you commit first, and do it in a way your enemy can see, you put Sir Newton on their side. If you have to commit like that, commit with a hammer they can't stop. 2 kilos of aggression can be worth 3 of sleight of hand. He grinned. The best stack, however, is a kilo of both. He lit up a hollow projector. Now this is what we all did. The recording played through rapidly, showing an hour-long exercise that would have been a 12-hour real-life battle in roughly a minute.
Vice Commodore Rocco spotted your mistake, and Commodore Ozolinch rammed 1,000 starfighters through it, he told them. I took the liberty, however, of running a simulated scenario of how you could have countered Ozolinch's maneuver. A new scenario played out. This time, as 7th Fleet's fighters began their hard charge toward the gap in the defending fighters' formation, hundreds of ECM drones flashed out from 41st Fleet's formation. In the original scenario, they'd been held for missile defense. In this one, Kyle used them to create a massive confusion over just where his starfighters were. It looked like they were still on their wide course, but in reality, they were using the cover of the drones to close up their formation. This time, 7th Fleet Strike ran into a solid wall of missiles and a closed-up starfighter formation. With AIs pretending to be pilots, the resulting fight was even more of a mutual massacre than it probably would be in reality. But far too few fighters made it through to threaten 41st Fleet. "We screwed up," he told his people, stressing the "we" to make sure they realized he was including himself. "We can do better. We have to do better. Walking Stick is going to send his best after us, and if we muck up like this in a real fight, the Commonwealth will be sending us home in boxes. And I don't know about you lot, but I have a kid and a fiancé I'd rather go home to in one piece." Chapter 13. Via Somnia System. 0800, August 28th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian, date, time. DSC 080, Elysium.
"Admiral on deck!"
Kyle shook his head at Sterling's booming voice and grinned impishly at his assembled starship captains and staff as he stepped up to the head of the conference table next to the flag bridge. There were only 5 people physically in the room, but even the 9 attending virtually were at least making an effort at standing to attention as he waved them all back to their seats.
"At ease, people," he told them. "We officially do not have time for Academy spit and polish today."
He took his own seat and grabbed the cup of coffee a steward had left waiting for him, studying his officers as he took a sip. It was an eclectic bunch. 6 Castle Federation captains, 3 Coraline Imperial Lord captains, and 1 Renaissance Trade Factor captain for starship commanders, plus the 4 Federation senior fleet commanders of his staff. Captain Bayal of Magellan stood out the most. The Trade Factor captain was one of the most obvious transhumans Kyle had ever met, with visible circuitry across their shaved head and a pair of mechanical tentacles mounted on their shoulders. Right now, the tentacles were relaxed, hanging down the captain's torso like silver suspenders over their breasts, but they still marked them as unique, even in this crowd. Novak sat at Kyle's right hand, Elysium's captain, one of the physically present officers. Captain Elijah Hammond, Avalon's new captain, sat to his left. Hammond's holographic image could have been Mira Salas's sibling, with the same dark skin and tall, slim build as the Admiral's fiancé. He seemed very aware that he commanded the Admiral's old ship, too. Both of Kyle's Federation battleship captains were cut from the same mold, older women with sharp features and pure white hair. Both Captain Edmonda Blue and Captain Lara McLeod were veterans of the last war with the Commonwealth, junior officers who'd spent the peace calmly accumulating experience and rank. His battlecruiser captains, however, were a study in contrast. Captain Augusta Pacannon of Carolus Rex was a squat woman with a short golden braid and a seemingly squashed face, where Captain Simon Tanaka of Genghis Khan was an almost eerily skinny and tall man with dark skin and folded eyes who towered easily 10 centimeters over his immense admiral. The 3 Imperial captains were equally varied. Lord Captain Josiane Vass of Righteous Light had almost luminescent gold hair that clashed dramatically with her pitch-black skin, where Lord Captain the Elector Maria von Kita of Righteous Sword looked like her family had left Japan last month instead of 400 years earlier, and Lord Captain Pino Mihailovich of Righteous Voice was as swarthy and dark-haired as his Russian last name suggested.
"We've had a week," Kyle noted.
None of the officers he'd been given were weak links. Few of the Alliance's less capable captains were in uniform, with the Commonwealth having taken care of many that the Alliance's member fleets hadn't caught in time.
"Does anyone have any immediate concerns?" he asked.
"Our mission profile calls for us to move out at midnight ESMDT, but I have a lot of discretion on that if we have a problem."
That was the advantage of his part of Operation Medusa. The deep strike fleets had to leave at particular times to make sure the final attack went down simultaneously. His own distraction effort was more flexible.
"Our starfighters have improved their coordination dramatically over that week,"
Von Keita noted.
"We still have occasional issues with senior officers from the Federation or Imperium requesting support that the other fighters can't provide."
She shook her head.
"We should have standardized our fighters as well as our missiles."
"It's being done," Kyle reminded her. "But we have the fighters we have. Have your CAGs focus on that concern, people. I'd suggest virtual exercises in each other's starfighters. Have our Falcon pilots fly virtual arrows and vice versa."
He smiled wickedly. "In fact, let's make sure that all of our starfighter pilots get at least 2 or 3 sim hours in a Vulture bomber. We need them to keep the bombers alive, and having a solid understanding of what a Vulture can and can't do won't hurt."
Nods carried around the room.
"Our starship coordination is still rusty,"
Bial noted in their oddly pitched voice.
"The battleships are maneuvering well together, but if we end up in a capital ship action, the battlecruisers need to work with us, and the carriers need to do a better job of hiding behind us."
Tanaka looked like he was about to say something, but Kyle held up a hand to cut him off. "The cruiser and carrier crews aren't as used to the idea of capital ship actions as the battle wagons people," he pointed out. "We can drill that in transit. Or are we that bad off, Captain?"
Bial shook their head.
"No,"
they replied.
"We're just rusty. As you say, we're not used to formation flying with capital ships. Virtual drills for the ship handlers while in transit should suffice to shake off the rust."
Kyle nodded.
"Anyone else?" he asked.
He glanced around, giving them a moment to raise their concerns, then nodded firmly and mentally issued a command to the conference software. A three-dimensional representation of the frontier between the Alliance and the Commonwealth appeared in the middle of the conference. The Alliance itself was highlighted in blue, and Terran space in red, and the occupied systems were blue circled in red.
"This is our area of operations," he said brightly. "As we speak, we have reason to believe that at least one, and more likely 2 or 3, Terran fleets are moving against key targets along the front. Walking Stick is taking his time to set things up, but we are quite certain the hammer is about to drop. For reasons I can't get into, we need him to hold off for about 8 weeks. Convincing the good marshal to chase us instead of hammering his way towards our homeworlds is now our job." He let that sink in, waiting for the inevitable question.
"How?"
Tanaka asked softly.
41st Fleet is a powerful formation, yes, but we can't take on Walking Stick's reserves or fortifications at Niagara."
"No, we can't," Kyle agreed. The Niagara system flashed onto the display. Home to the Commonwealth's biggest fleet base on this frontier, it anchored Walking Stick's campaigns and was home to enough defenses to laugh at half a dozen capital ships on their own, and a defensive fleet more powerful than his own.
But 4 systems near Niagara flashed, bright green carrots appearing around them. Niagara is a relatively lightly inhabited system in its own right, and, perhaps most importantly, has never had a large surplus of food. The industrial plant that came with the fleet base can do a lot of things, but all it can do for food is recycled protein. A grimace ran around the room and Kyle grinned again.
"Exactly. Even the most willing of crews start losing their enthusiasm when they know they're eating protein bars made of their own waste. These 4 systems are key to Niagara's logistics pipeline," he explained. "They provide food, raw materials, replacement small tech components, the works. The fleet base doesn't need them, but without them, their morale and efficiency are going to plummet. That said, if we just fly in and level the orbital infrastructure of those systems, they'll know we knew exactly what to hit. They'll know what systems to defend, and they can secure them with, say, 12 capital ships apiece.
How much of Walking Stick's force do we need to draw down?
Bayal asked, sounding curious as they studied the astrographic chart.
All of it, Kyle told them all. To do that, we can't be obvious. We need to keep Walking Stick and his people jumping, and we need to hit the good marshal in the only weak spot the bastard seems to have, his political superiors.
A new flashing carrot appeared on the display, locking on to an entirely different system. I also want to test this fleet out against an easy target, and send a message to the Commonwealth that while we are playing by the rules of war, we aren't playing by their rules anymore, he concluded grimly. Which brings us to the Oswiri system. 25 light-years from here, almost 30 light-years into Commonwealth space. Via Somnia, of course, was already well into Terran space. Oswiri is a system of almost no importance to anyone. Minimal exportable surpluses. A small Commonwealth Navy refueling facility. Defenses at last record were two fighter stations mothering 100 Scimitar-type fighters apiece and half a dozen gunships. We should be able to secure the system without losses of our own, at which point we will give them 48 hours to evacuate all non-residential spaceborne platforms. Kyle sighed. He did not like this part of his mission, even though he'd written the recommendation himself. And then we will blow their entire industrial plant to dust bunnies, he told his people, his voice quiet. We will minimize civilian casualties. To zero, if we can. And scrupulously adhere not merely to the letter but the spirit of interstellar law. This will not be Hessian. The system where Kyle had suffered NSID and where the new war had begun had seen its infrastructure crushed by a retreating Commonwealth fleet, with its civilian workforce still aboard. I will neither order nor permit atrocities. But the destruction of Oswiri's orbital industry will add to the political pressure on Marshal Walking Stick to come after us, and the raid on a minor system will leave them guessing where we're going to hit next. Two or three raids of this nature should force him to pull back the lion's share of his fleet to try and intercept us, which is exactly what the Alliance needs. We're playing Matador, people, and we need to make sure the bull doesn't gore us. He grimaced, looking around to test the resolve and understanding of his officers. At the end of the day, though, he said quietly, 41st Fleet is expendable so long as we do our job. The Alliance needs Walking Stick watching us. Sooner or later, that means we're going to get hammered. Our job is to minimize the losses we take when that happens. I want you to be clear on that, and make sure your juniors understand as well, he told them. We will have objectives and targets for each raid, but absolutely nothing we are going after is an all-costs target. I have every intention of abandoning attacks if the defenses are too heavy, and of outright flight if a heavy force arrives while we are mid-operation. We can't distract Walking Stick if we're dead. Chapter 14 Oswiri System 1200, September 7th, 2737, Earth Standard Meridian Date Time. Alliance 41st Fleet. Emergence bubbles glittered in the darkness, the blue flare of Cherenkov radiation bursts lighting up the void around the star Oswiri. Starship after starship emerged from the nothingness, 10 capital ships forming a protective dome around 3 logistics ships. The first ship out had, of course, been Elysium, and Vice Commodore Michelle Williams Alvarez's starfighter had been in space before half of 41st Fleet's capital ships had entered the star system. Her starfighters and bombers mirrored the formation of the fleet, the single wing of vultures guarded by a moving shield of falcons. Her starfighters were out in front, but Avalon's group was only a few thousand kilometers behind her, and the rest of the fleet's fighters joined up rapidly, the lead wings keeping their acceleration down until the entire massed fist of Alliance ships had assembled. "Are we seeing any reaction from the locals yet?" Michelle asked her gunner, an aggressively average-appearing man named Ferdy Eklund. "Our Q-probes are barely a dozen light seconds ahead of us," he pointed out. "We're still seeing what they were doing 2 minutes ago."
"And we arrived 10 minutes ago now, so..."
Eklund coughed. "And if they had seen us 2 minutes ago, they hadn't done anything to suggest it," he told her.
Nobody is doing anything in orbit.
She shook her head and dipped into the long-range sensor feed. She wasn't surprised to confirm what Eklund had said, but she needed to see it herself. 6 Commonwealth Scythe-class gunships, 500,000-ton mobile missile platforms with few saving graces. 2 Zion-class starfighter platforms, each rated for 5 10-ship squadrons. A single one of those squadrons flying a standard high guard patrol above the planet Indus. The Oswiri system definitely had potential. A good-sized asteroid belt, a pair of mid-sized gas giants, an inhabitable planet. The colonists had been sensible and kept most industry in orbit while slowly expanding the population on the surface. It wasn't a rich system, but it was clearly self-sustaining and had been carefully laying the groundwork for staying self-sustaining while becoming rich. Michelle felt a twinge of guilt. Much of that groundwork was in the orbital infrastructure they were here to destroy. It wasn't much of a twinge of guilt. Spacers and resources from this world fueled the war machine that was grinding down her own people and had smashed 6 systems' key orbital infrastructure. It was war, and Turnabout was fair play.
All right, people, we've got 3 sets of targets on the board and only 1 is armed.
Vice Commodore Robert Lakatos's voice echoed over the tactical net. Avalon's CAG was the senior starfighter officer in the fleet, which made him Fleet CAG. Thankfully, he was usually willing to listen to advice from his juniors.
SFG-306, SFG-059, he reeled off, naming the fighter groups from Carolus Rex and Genghis Khan.
Those groups were purely starfighters with no bombers.
Each of you gets a gas giant's infrastructure, Lakatos told them. You know the drill. They have 48 hours to evacuate all non-residential platforms, then you blow them to hell. They probably have starfighters in place to guard them, but you'll have them outnumbered by far. Play it safe. I'd rather none of us were writing letters home when this is over, clear?
Over 140 starfighters split off from the main group, 2 groups of 72 heading towards each gas giant and its orbiting cloud scoops.
Everyone else, he continued, form on SFG-012. Williams, you launched first. You get to go first.
She grinned.
Bombers lead the way, sir, she told him crisply.
Exactly. The Admiral wants to make this a show. Let's give them one. And get everyone home.
Still no response from the locals? Kyle asked.
Nothing,
Sterling confirmed. That was weird. Intelligence records suggested that Oswiri saw maybe 3 interstellar transports in a month. 13 starships showing up on their sensors should have earned some reaction. But he could see the same thing his chief of staff could. 41st Fleet was accelerating toward the planet at 210 gravities, and their starfighter strikes were zipping along at just over 500 gravities. The energy flare from over 1,000 antimatter drives was probably visible from the ground, but no one was reacting at all. The gunships remained in orbit. The fighter platforms remained quiet.
We're in bloody missile range, Sterling complained. What would they do if we started launching?
Take a nap and decide what to do with the missiles in 30 minutes or so? Kyle suggested with a chuckle. Even our missiles have a 42-minute flight time. They've got a lot of time to respond to us, but
if I had 100 starfighters and 6 20-year-old gunships to defend a system, I'd be freaking out at even 1 warship, let alone 10,
Captain Novak interjected.
What's the plan, sir?
Well, I was expecting them to give me a call by now, he replied. But someone has to get the ball rolling. We don't really have the time to be subtle, so get me an omnidirectional broadcast.
On it,
Sterling confirmed.
Recording linked to your implant. You have the call.
Kyle smiled broadly, looked into the pickup, and activated the recorder.
Residents and defenders of the Oswiri system, he greeted them. I am Vice Admiral Kyle Roberts of the Alliance of Free Stars. We could pretend that your handful of defenders were going to make a difference here, but that would be a waste of everyone's time. I am now in possession of your star system. The destruction of the Commonwealth forces here is inevitable, and I strongly recommend their surrender.
Regardless of whether they choose to fight an impossible battle, my clock starts now. You have 48 hours to evacuate all spaceborne industrial platforms,